Today we're spreading the Spanish flu. Epidemics have been with us since the First Fleet. Around that time, smallpox ravaged the Aboriginal people, probably introduced by the first convicts and settlers. There was an outbreak of bubonic plague in Sydney in 1900, then of course the polio epidemics of the mid-20th century. More recently we've had swine fever, SARS and Ebola, among others, and now we've got the coronavirus, a global pandemic. We've been here before. I'm Graeme Seal, and along with Rob Willis, we'll be doing the odd podcast under the title Yarns of Oz. You'll be hearing the voices of everyday Australians who live through the eras and events that we'll be covering, along with a bit of music, verse, and whatever else contributes to these unusual but authentic sidelights on our history and folklore.
Graeme, just to put a bit of a clarification on all of this, it was about 1918 to 1920, wasn't it, that Australia and the world suffered a pandemic that killed millions, which was more than World War One, wasn't it?
That's right, yes. It was widespread. It came from America rather than Spain. It's just that they first noticed it in Spain, probably brought to Europe by American troops in 1917 to 1918. And then, of course, when it caught on there, and then when the troops started coming back to Australia, of course, they were infected with it, or many of them were anyway. And, things went very nasty very quickly.
Let's have a little listen to a verse that Maureen, your wife, has kindly put down for us. I suppose this would probably be like the current memes and things like that. So let's have a bit of a listen to it.
Dubbo, Liberal, February 7th, 1919. A splitting head and limbs of lead, a burning throat and dry. Add to these woes a snuffly nose, a red and streamy eye. Thermometer beneath my tongue reads 104.2 instead of the normal 98. I've got the Spanish flu.
Yeah, so I suppose that with social media we're getting all this information and the jocular sort of stuff, which would have been in those days in the paper, I would imagine.
It seems the way it goes, Rob. Yeah, the need to sort of send things up and have a laugh in awkward situations is very much still with us, of course, and the technology has improved immensely. And so nowadays, instead of these little parodies and ditties and squibs like that one in the newspapers, of course, we've got the wonderful, and sometimes wonderful, not always wonderful, internet and the memes and the fake news and the various rumours and other kinds of things and the GIFs, as you mentioned, that come around all the time, Facebook and social media generally. Pretty much, I think, the modern equivalent of that.
It'd be interesting to know if these are being collected in some way too, because, I mean, we're lucky that within our National Library's trove, we have reference to these little verses, these songs and these ditties, but hopefully in the future, because we're going through a historical event here, that there will be some record of all the things we're talking about.
Yeah, I'd like to think so. Certainly, trove's a wonderful thing if you're doing research on anything printed in the past, and many people are, of course. Even that was quite a large amount of material, nothing like what we got in the digital world, of course. So I don't know if anyone is actually crunching this stuff somewhere and popping it away in an archive. It would have to be a very big one.
It'd be very large.
Yeah, and there'd be an awful lot of work organising and cataloguing it. So we're probably all going to depend on Facebook and the other social media things that are up there in the cloud and hope the cloud stays there.
Yes, it's going to be interesting for historians like yourself in the future, I think. So maybe you're lucky to be in this era and not in a future era.
I think so.
Let's talk about a bit of the history from the Spanish flu. I live in Forbes, as we know, and we've got a few records of it coming here, which, thank goodness, the current virus hasn't as yet. But there's a lot of similarities from what I can see. And even the way that it was brought to Australia on the troop ships.
That's right, yeah. I mean, it's a bit like cruise ships, isn't it?
Yes.
There were 300-odd troop ships returning, and they reckon that around about half of those, or a bit less than half, probably had infections aboard. So because we're here in Australia, of course, we'd heard about this happening over in Europe before the troops actually arrived. So we immediately put up quarantine and all those troops off those infected ships had to go into quarantine. The first one arrived in Darwin in October 1918, and they kept coming in after that in various other ports. People weren't happy, of course, but they had to be put into quite long quarantines at various quarantine stations. Quite a few people tried to break out today. It was all pretty nasty, but the first case didn't really get notified until January 1919 in Melbourne. The cause of it was really never discovered, but it didn't reach Western Australia, where I'm located, again, a bit like today, until June 1919 it was, yeah. And it took its toll here as well, but nowhere near as much as in other places.
It's interesting you made the comment there about the cruise ships and the comparison between the troop ships and the cruise ships, because those troop ships must have been alive with the virus.
Many of them were, yeah. Again, like everything else, it's a bit hit and miss, depending on whether you're being lucky or unlucky, but certainly, as I said, around about half of them were considered to be infected. So there were an awful lot of men who were, in quarantine. It seemed to target middle-aged men, the Spanish flu.
Uh-huh.
And, about 25 to 34-year-old, and probably 2 million people were infected in Australia. Population was about 5 million then. And so it was quite a big deal. There's no two ways about that.
Let's go back to my hometown of Forbes, and over the years I've been recording a lot of the history of this for our oral. We're both involved with the National Library Oral History section, of course, another great resource. I recorded a Mrs. Honberg of Forbes, and she was born about the early 1900s and can remember this. It's a sad part when you're an oral historian, though, that sometimes in retrospect you look back and you think, I should have asked more about that. And this is one of those cases. So let's have a listen to Helen Honberg talking about the flu in Forbes.
There, and I was about 7 or 8, and the bubonic flu broke out. And I was always over at Mrs. Webster following around, the old lady, and I can remember the police. And they had a son, Jack, and he died from pneumonic flu. And I can always remember the police there, they had masks on, and they said, is that your little girl? And she said, no, I've crossed the road, and I was sent home. Because quite a lot of them died in the...
Did they?
Well, the showground was... All the hospitals were full, and the showground was full.
Because of this bubonic plague?
Yes. Oh. And it was really bad. And I can remember my father, he drank kerosene.
Did he?
He reckoned that he was everything was kerosene. When we all had a cold, we had 5 drops of kerosene on a teaspoon of sugar. And if you got a sore, you got kerosene on, and it's done the trick.
It's funny, yes, people still use that, you know.
Yes, but it's not really good kerosene now. It's high octane. It's not the real...
Not the real
it's blue looking now. You wouldn't drink it.
So don't do this at home, kiddies. Don't take the kerosene.
Definitely not. No, it's not as good as it was, she says.
That's right.
Oh, yeah. So don't bother. Yeah. Mind you, it probably would have done you more good than some of the snake oil that was around at the time, of course. The famous Henzo, money-saving treatment for coughs, colds, influenza, asthma, bronchitis, guitar, whooping cough and sore throats, that you could get from all leading chemists and stores for just $2. And that kind of mixture, I guess, was something that was recommended to people for curing the flu,
the flu,
as well as everything else.
And they had a unique way of marketing too. A little verse that you've kindly contributed to. Let's have a listen to the Henzo verse.
A flu song. Sunday time, Sunday the 1st of June, 1919. Jane Joybell had contracted flu. Her aching head throbbed through and through, her burning eyes in anguish rolled, and hoarseness marred her voice of gold. Her temples throbbed in every vein, the slightest movement caused her pain. Upon her couch in mute despair, for kingdom come, she did prepare.
Pretty morbid.
Yes, the melancholy morbidity was definitely part of the mode at the time. Yeah, but it's so bad that it kind of it's funny.
And it's interesting, I think, too, that some pretty famous people actually contributed verse to the Heinzo advertising campaign, if you wish.
Yeah, they certainly used a lot of celebrities and well-known people in show business of one kind or another to endorse their product, of course. And one in particular that we'll know well was Henry Lawson. He wrote poems for them, spruiking the delights and virtues of Heinzo. But there were an awful lot of them in the papers of the time, and people were kind of continually bombarded with the wonders of Heinzo.
So we've got Joy Bell very just about on a deathbed, so let's have a listen to the second verse.
Her coughs and aches grew less each dose. She therefore kept the Heinzo close, till very soon her flu had flown, and now Jane makes it widely known that you must buy for shillings too Heinzo enough to beat the flu. And what is more, these costly times, when cost of living higher climbs, is that by using Heinzo you will save in cash a pound or two.
Well, there you go.
Well, there you go. It's cheap as well. Yeah, it works and it's cheap and it'll cure everything, I reckon.
Yeah, and also that these, I won't say fake remedies because they must have done something. Henry probably enjoyed a tipple of Heinzo. It would have had some good stuff in it, I would imagine. But even some of our world leaders are saying that a particular remedy can fix things. But anyway, let's have a listen to the last bit, the spiel, the final wind-up on Heinzo.
Heinzo, the famous money-saving treatment for coughs, colds, influenza, asthma, bronchitis, catarrh, whooping cough and sore throats, is obtainable from all leading chemists and stores, priced just 2 shillings. As each bottle of Heinzo produces a family supply of finest quality mixture, when added to sweetened water, as per easy directions printed on the label, it will be seen that in addition to getting quickest possible relief, you effect a big money-saving by using Heinzo.
So things haven't changed much, even though the method of, shall we say, selling product is has changed, it's still there.
Yep, yeah, you've still got to spruik your product, definitely. You're going to have, people wanting to buy it or purchase it, even though there's no evidence.
And it brings back to a general way that we that messages were distributed going back to the 1919, where people were gathering on street corners to spread rumours, but now it's all done through social media. So it gets back to that point, I believe, that nothing much has changed, only the way that things are distributed.
Yeah, that's it. That's pretty much what we learned from folklore, I think. Nothing much really changes. It just seems to on the surface. And certainly with the internet, it just amplifies the the negative side of rumour mongering and fake news, as we've all come to know in recent years.
That's right. And, talking about folklore, of course, we're both involved with this through our own work and the work at the National Library. I'm going to play you a grab from Sid Briggs of Young, who was in isolation during the 1919 pandemic. But let's have a listen to what he was doing.
I learnt that of a music book.
Oh, and it's called Smith's Lilt.
Yeah.
I thought he might have been a local man.
I learnt that in 1919, the time I had the pneumonic flu.
Oh, yes.
I had the pneumonic flu, I nearly died with it. Yes, I learnt that like when I was getting better.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that was after the First World War, wasn't it, that pneumonic flu?
Yeah. Yes, it finished 18 and 19 the world. But all over the world, that.
That's right.
Pneumonic flu. Started in New Zealand, I think.
Is it?
Quite a lot died here.
Yeah.
Well, we have to blame the Kiwis, didn't we?
We certainly did. It's a grand old Australian tradition.
Yeah. So being in isolation did have its benefits for Sid, and you must remember that Sid was 90 when John Meredith and I recorded him many, many years ago, so his playing skills weren't the best. His Smith's lilt was I'd imagine in his younger days pretty good.
I'm sure he was.
Yeah. Graham, what we call black humour or gallows humour is an important part of who we are too, I think, isn't it, in times of crisis?
Oh, definitely. Wars, of course, and this relates to war as well, I guess, but certainly when catastrophe and disaster strike, one of the ways we deal with it is to have a laugh and laugh it off, make light, and a lot of the things that we're playing today, of course, and we'll hear as we go through are certainly in that, as you say, black humour of one kind or another, but very necessary kind of laughter.
Yeah, and there's a lot of the, we're continually talking about social media and how it's being utilised. There's a lot of that dark humour that comes through in the stuff that I get on Facebook and other ways too.
Yeah, you get lots and lots of that, and you can't really turn it off.
Well, getting back to newspapers, this is a verse that we picked up that our friend Dennis McKay from Canoundra has done for us. It's called The Digger and the Flue.
The Digger and the Flue, an anonymous poem from the Cairns Post, Tuesday, June 3rd, 1919. Before I fell a victim to the wiles of Spanish flu, I'd gathered from the posters and certain movies too, that when it came to nurses, you always woke to view some peach of dove-like beauty who slipped the pills to you. I've read the artful fiction about the angels fair who sat beside your pillow and stroked your fevered hair and made you kind of careless how long you lingered there in the radiant effulgence of a lovely baby stare. That may be true in cases, the way it is in plays, but mine was no white lady of lilting roundelays. While I was outed with the flu, the nurse who soothed my pain was Private Billy Rogers that fired on the Herberton train.
So they drop you off at the end, as is usual, any good yarn.
Might be a slow train.
I gather that was a poem from one of the soldiers who may have caught it while he was still in the army too and was missing out on the attentions of the beautiful nurses of the day.
Definitely. It was a time of poetry too. I mean, everybody wrote poetry. I mean, you went to school, you learned poetry, of course, not that kind of poetry much, but proper poetry, you know, from the and the, you know, romantic poets and so forth. But everybody turned their hand to poetry, it seems, and all the C.J. Dennis stuff is a kind of sophisticated example of some of the things that the diggers themselves were writing and writing and writing and writing. You know, it was a way of getting your feelings out and communicating.
That's a very interesting point, isn't it, that the way of communicating it through verse, I've noticed in our particular circumstance now, there's a lot of song going around, people gathering on social media or Zoom or whatever, and songs. So this folklore, these songs, these ditties are a vital part of who we are, apparently.
And as we said earlier, a vital way of dealing with the whole thing. You've got whole communities in Europe sitting on their balconies having community music sessions. You know, and people are playing and singing and dancing all together across the street from balcony to balcony. It's a great sight, and people are obviously using that as a release, a way of dealing with their situation.
Yeah, and we're very good at making do. I mean, we're recording this about a week before Anzac Day, and I know, again, getting back to my hometown of Forbes, that everyone's getting, at 6 o'clock for the dawn service, they're asking that everyone goes outside and just stands there, and the band are going to play outside their houses and bringing that sense of community, even though we can't get together.
That's definitely it. And also, of course, the sense of tradition that goes with it, I guess, the fact that this is something we've always done and it's necessary for us to do it in some way, even though we can't do it in the usual manner. So people have come up with different ways of celebrating and commemorating.
Mm. As I said, we've recorded quite about half a dozen people who lived through the 1919 flu epidemic. This is probably one of the best ones from a fellow by the name of Rocky Wedd, who lived in Gormanston in Tasmania. And let's have a listen to Rocky.
I came home 1918, and at the beginning of 1919, the pneumonic flu struck.
Oh, yes.
That struck the district up there. And, of course, I wasn't allowed to go back. I had to start the apprenticeship. Now, that demonic flu, the whole town put it down on this Sunday morning. Mother came in and said to Dad, everybody had fired it. She said, come out and have a look. She said, there's no, very few fires about the place. She said, there's something wrong. See? So we went out and had a look. And after we had breakfast, Mother said to me, she said, I'm going around, down some of the neighbours. We lived back on a hill in Boston. She went down, went around, came back. She said, they've all got a sort of flu or something. She said, they're bleeding at the nose, some of them, headaches and all different things. She said, it's terrible. She said, oh, I must get some stuff ready. She said, go and help somebody. She said, one man up there, Charles, he's very bad. She said, he wants egg flips. So she goes away with a bag of eggs and a bottle of brandy and the milk. And because it was all tin milk, made up milk then. And that's what she did. She never ever got the flu.
It's pretty graphic in the way that you're describing nosebleeds and things like that. Gormanston was very isolated in Tasmania, and it must have been quite a shock.
Yeah, I mean, they're going through it again now too, aren't they, in rural Tasmania. The whole idea of being in a remote regional location doesn't necessarily work very well at all. Once the bug's there, it can go right through the local community.
And it's interesting, we'll just have a listen to this second part of that grab from Rocky, and he talks about timber getters who were completely isolated getting it without being in contact with anyone.
And then Dad, the staff quarters up there, staff club quarters, they turned into a small hospital. They took the worst cases up there, and Dad had a job of organising that. And he got the flu right at the finish. And all us kids, we had the flu, had the pneumonic flu, but Mum never got it. And there was a couple of persons died up there. That there was woodcutters down the Kelly Basin line, all the way down there. That was a 29 mile line from Linda, the other end of Macquarie Harbour, the Kelly pillage at Kelly Basin. And some of the woodcutters walked in to Linda for stores, and they said that some of their mates had the flu. They called the flu out there, didn't know it was a pneumonic flu. So that must have been in the air. They got the same time as they got in Gormanston.
Dear idea.
And they were 20 miles, 18, 20 miles out in the bush.
Goodness gracious me.
Of course, there was no road to Hobart then, no road to sea in a storm or. Anyway, the only way he got into Queenstown was by the railway line.
So that was isolation.
Oh, definitely. And the virus coming on the wind, that's a bit of a worry, isn't it? It does seem a rather long way for a virus to get blown.
And funnily, I remember that John Meredith, who has done did a lot of recording for the National Library, of course, one of the early people recording folklore and social history, he often told me that there were several cases of that happening, that he can remember people talking about it, that distance away, it had been blown in by the wind. So whether it's folklore or whatever, it's interesting. But what's coming through, I think, in the whole lot of this, Graeme, is the comparisons or the similarities, shall we say, between 1919 and 2020. So we've got 1919 and 2020. There you go.
That's folklore.
That's folklore. And as you say, nothing much has changed.
Not really. I mean, the official and state responses back in 1919 began off well, as did, but then they quickly descended into a bit of a squabble between everybody. And at one point, the Commonwealth, I think, even withdrew from all the arrangements, but they came back in again later on. But there was a shortage of masks, there was a shortage of beds, people were isolated, obviously, just like this time. So it's just one of those things, I guess, that once it comes around again, well, we react the same way, even though we've got much better technology and medicine. But it's just like the last time. So, a century between pandemics, but people did and have reacted in much the same way during other events, laughing, learning and finding ways to cope with them. On the negative side, the usual corporate suspects found ways to make a buck, peddling snake oil. Today we have the same thing, amplified with fake news and the internet. Well, that same technology has also allowed people to be alone together as they go through social isolation and quarantine. And we battle on, it seems, with the same kind of resilience as the old timers 100 years ago. We laugh it off, a joke from a driver of a bus full of potential COVID-19 victims in March this year. Don't worry, he said, the virus won't last long. It's made in China. And like a lot of black humour, this one's based on prejudice, of course, but it certainly relieved the tension on the bus. You've been listening to an episode in the Yarns of Oz podcast, written, produced and presented by Rob Willis, Graham Seal, Dennis Mackay and Maureen Seal. See you later.